Christ. We're live. Not, you don't expect me live, except on Sunday. And some of you skeptics are saying, particularly you voices of faith that were supposed to be here and aren't. Well, now, we listen to reruns in which we hear him say, when it was first recorded, we're live. So hopefully, since I'm supposed to be there as a voice of faith, this is a rerun, and we're hearing on the rerun him say we're live. Five, we are. I've never said that before. Live, we are. At least in here. It is festival time. I'm bothered about two things. We are 61 reservations short. Now, if you want me to close the cathedral, and this brings back memories. I do not remember in recent years, as we approach my anniversary, that all hell doesn't break loose in your life and faithlessness replaces faith until I think my staff can testify that every year I begin to question we will make it in that last 2 weeks. Diabolical that on this week before anniversary and with the good news that we have going back into Dallas, and we'll be on Channel 27 in Dallas, the station we really started on in Dallas. On Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, and to my surprise today, a station in Enid, Oklahoma, about 75 miles from Oklahoma City. The owners own Cox, a channel on Cox Cable also. Calls been coming in here from people saying, we haven't seen you in years in Oklahoma because we used to be on in Tulsa and other places. And they're carrying us 24 hours a day, free. Don't start clapping and making people feel good because I want them to feel bad. That is good news. I have a pretty strong and terrifying, if you listen, message to those that are so overexposed to God's goodness and to God's Word and to the things of God. That they turn God off on them completely. I've been getting lots of calls, and I appreciate it, from people that have needed the excursion we've done on faith in the Roman series. And you have grabbed those promises, and they're true. But there is a danger zone. The same words bring life to some and death to others. And the tragedy is that when the words bring in death to you, you don't know it. That thin line between stumbling and falling short and presumptuous sin. What in the Roman series we spend a lot of time on, the distinction between surface, shub, which is used to translate what normally we call repentance. Well, I think we've done that word in a little bit. Life change. Metanoia. A learned way of taking advantage, like spoiled kids that know their parents' weakness of love. And they know how to work them. We're not talking about new converts. We're not talking about the burden down sinner in the book Pilgrim's Progress that can only faintly see the light of the door that enters him on the Christian walk, and who needs his burden to fall off, and it does at the door as he enters. But then interpreter takes over, and he begins to progress in the Christian journey. We're not talking about those untrained, ignorant, beaten down, burdened slaves in Egypt, that because of God's word of promise to Abraham, he was going to deliver and put up with their human traits and godless traits, and would let the leader Moses do it all against their opposition. We're talking about those that have walked, and they just want a free ride. They want it all my way. They want one-sided love and one-sided faithfulness. They want love all those promises I've been teaching. And they never progress beyond that. They never become someone that God can really count on. Now, there are exceptions. The statistics are kind of bad. If 3.25 million went out of Egypt, two of them, beyond teenagers, made it in. Two of them of what we would call in modern day legal age, when they left Egypt, made it in. Caleb and Joshua. Moses didn't make it, and I'm going to tell you some of his foolishness in a few minutes. Joshua and Caleb. Aaron didn't make it. Miriam didn't make it. Oh, she could sing and dance like nobody else when they went across the Red Sea. And they only had 3.5 years of training up to Kadesh Barnea. And there are people in this church with 10, 15, 20, 25, 27, 28 years come a week from Sunday. Next Sunday's the last Sunday of my 27th year as pastor. And you would slap me and God in the face by being, listen to the number, 61 short. I mean, every week the battle is over 35 to 50 faithless people. And if I drop the quota, I can guarantee you, if I were to drop the quota by 100, the very first week that I dropped the quota by 100, the reservations would be 25 or 30 under. Which means it would still be about the same range of people subject to the devil who want to take all the blessings that I've been teaching you about and all the promises, but do not want to make a commitment, an unbreakable commitment, a faithful commitment, till death do us part. I will be in that cathedral on Sunday if I'm able to walk or move. What is it, 168 hours in a week? Well, it seems to me that that 4 hour, considering turnaround time, service, all that's involved, that 4 hours, that most other churches have more than that in actual church service time with their Sunday morning, Sunday night, and midweek services and choir practice and prayer meeting and etc. Somebody quickly, you do it for me, Brian. Figure the percentage that 4 hours is of 168. When you owe 10% of your time to God, just as you owe your tithe, to the work of the church that is your source of spiritual food. You're going to find, what is it? 2.4%. That means you have 7.6% of additional time you owe to this church every week. Well, split it in half and say, well, I'm sleeping 12 hours a day. I don't know what kind of lazy oaf would do that. And say, then 5% of the 168 you owe to God, you're still less than half of the time that's due. Commit to the cathedral. Well, when I'm done with you tonight, you're going to figure out that some of these promises I'm teaching are not available to certain people. Well, why do you teach them? Well, I'm going to show you that God taught a lot of things, wonderful and blessed promises to people that they were not available to. And I'm not going to Isaiah 6, because I've already told you about that, where God called and said, who will go for me? And Isaiah said, I'll go, send me. And I grew up in a church world that would always quote that task and that text and have people commit themselves to be missionaries or ministers or this or that. And they never read the next line. Okay, you're going to go, but all your preaching is going to result in zero. I'm not sending you to save these people. I'm not sending you to preach to them because it will change them. I'm not sending you to preach to them because it will help them. I'm not sending you, well, my word won't return void. Right. Because the same word has dual purpose. It sorts out. You're going to preach to these people until there's nothing left but a barren wasteland. And as forests of trees, they'll all be cut down to add up wrath. See, hell's not one big trap door where punishment's all the same, and just getting your big toe in is going to be worse than anything you can dream of. That there are layers and layers and layers. And the God who created all the desires of your heart and all that is has a sufficient imagination to create pain unmeasurable and unimaginable. And he's got an audience. And though whatever he does is right, what he does is right. Not just because he does it, but because it's right. And there's nobody going to be able to say, They didn't deserve it. He's figured out their nature. So he's going to heap on, through the mouth of Isaiah, he's going to heap on the message so that the measure of their rejection is magnified with no intention or expectancy that there'll be a response. Because they crossed a line with him. Oh, I heard some movie star talking. Frankly, I like her. I think she's a wonderful Christian. But you can be a movie star and still need to be taught. But, you know, we bow to sports figures and movie stars and finance managers. If they get saved, then they become instant experts in religion. I heard her saying, God is love. Therefore, it's proper to say, love, in the beginning, love. Love is an attribute of God, but in the beginning, God was God. He didn't say, when Moses said, who's sending me, he didn't say love. He said, I am that I am. I can be whatever I want to be. Be thankful I'm loving. But I am is before love, and love is part of I am. And wherever I am, love is there, but there's some other ingredients of my nature too. And believe you me, exposure to love will be maximized sufficient that your rejection makes you get what you deserve. Now, my job as a pastor is to give comfort to the sinner because they aren't in yet, and there is comfort in that they can move from where they are to a destiny that's eternal and wonderful. But you need some discomfort. And your presumptuous, complacent taking of your pastor and God and the message of faith and grace to a perversion of me first. Never God first. Now, I don't need the cathedral as much as you do. And I'm looking at 65 to go with Secret 15. 65 people that don't have the faith to believe that they and God, as of months ago, could get 5,000 above their tithe in by Christmas. Now you got 2 months. You tell me this is not spiritual warfare when there's 61 reservations short of the quota and 65 secret 15 commitments short of the goal. You're kissing the devil. And you're just like the Israelites. You want this 73-year-old pastor to kill himself every night, trying to remake this organization with a staff that drags their feet in inertia, which I'm going to address tonight. And you'll come when I prove to you that I'll be here live, but you won't come here if I'm not. Now, there are a few exceptions to what I'm saying. And I know that, God knows that, and you know that. So get on my side and start applauding while I deal with those that are going to bring you down with them for their faithlessness. Now, get your ass straightened out and start making your reservations and start making your pledges, because I'm going to do some teaching tonight, and I don't want to spend too much time getting the reservations in here. Unless you want the cathedral closed on Sunday and no anniversary service, you better get on the phone and make your reservations. Now, start it now. Now, it is tragic that I have to deal with this Los Angeles congregation like Moses and God dealing with the self-serving, faithless Israelites. The congregation that has 27 years of 24-hour-a-day broadcast availability multiple means of listening. And have to do it with folks in Enon, Oklahoma and around listening for the first time, because we've come on 24 hours a day on that station. Just as Israel is written across the pages of God's book as an embarrassment to God, you're an embarrassment to this ministry. As I've told you, only one Sunday since last April, when I announced Secret 15 and asked you to help me take this mountain, the focus being the cathedral, only one Sunday since April have the reservations reached the quota. That ought to tell you how susceptible you are to the devil and his attacks. A line was drawn in the sand. You were given a chance to declare yourself on God's side. You failed every single week except one. And you're failing tonight. Of course, I've begun to question quite a bit of late the value of Channel 38 here in Los Angeles. But I think there are enough people listening on satellite, shortwave, and the whole world has to stand by while I deal with the Los Angeles overfed congregation. Instead of holding my arms up, you drag them down. I have a message for you tonight. And with the grieving heart of a genuine pastor, I worry if I'm trying what God's already given up on. I'm in good company. It's what Moses did with Hagar and Ishmael. I mean, what Abraham did with Hagar and Ishmael. What Abraham earlier did with his family. And then with Lot. And what Moses did with the Israelites, to the loss of his own opportunity to go in the Promised Land. Oh, there's a hardcore nucleus in this church that's the best congregation in 2,000 years. They're a small core with a lot of hangers-on. And self-serving fringe participants. This is not a church designed to serve you. You're not even in the church until you belong to the Lord. The church is a people that belong to the Lord. What the word means, Kyriakon, the Lord's. You say, well, what about ecclesiastical or ecclesia, the other word for church? It's outcalled ones. Outcalled ones. Called out. Following him. I want one more song to give those that are listening that haven't participated and know they should a chance to make a commitment to Secret 15. I've got 53 to go now in reservations for the cathedral. And then I want to start teaching after this song, so you better move this time fast. I want my wife, Melissa, who's directing, to send all the crew members she doesn't need out here. They need this message more than anybody. So just send them out here. And finish your calls. The calls that you're on, and then no more calls. Bring me what you got, Reggie. I want to refresh your... And I'm going to wait till everybody's settled. Hurry up, guys, and get your seats. And get seats where I can see you, because I want to see if you go to sleep so I can know where you're at. You know, many years ago, and repeatedly over the years, I have said to this congregation, as I deal openly and honestly with you, I worried about the von Bowman syndrome. And I told you the story how von Bowman, one of the greatest pastors of the Assemblies of God, and one of the pastors that had a great influence on me, started a church in Detroit when he was 19. Pastored it for 40 years. At the time, one of the three or four largest churches in the Assemblies of God. Big multi-million dollar complex in Detroit. Brightmoor Tabernacle. I preach there regularly in teaching missions. But I got a call from him out of the blue, and he called me. He said he had prayed for 4 years and that, as he put it, God had showed him I was the only person to succeed him. He flew out to talk to me. I was in Oroville at the time, here in California, and he said, repeated it, his feelings, and opened his heart and said, you know, I've grown up with this church, and I have staff people and volunteers that have fought through the battles with me, but they stopped growing. We're at the cusp of breaking out into the future that the church has been prepared for, and they're not ready to go on with me. They're comfortable, included music directors, song leaders, deacons, staff people. They just liked it the way it was, comfort zone. And he said, I just don't have the heart to eliminate them, so they're standing in the way. They have fought by my side through, in other words, the love ratio was like that of a family. They're good people. They've just lost their vision. And you can come in, Gene, as a new broom. You don't have any of these emotional connections. And clean house and build a staff that's fresh and new and move forward. I never said this, even said most of them are 40 and 50 years old. some of them approaching 60, I haven't the heart to turn them out. And they haven't the commitment to change or to be supportive of change, because ego's involved with their positions. They just resist anything that breaks their comfort zone. I said, Bon, you've prayed for 4 years, I haven't prayed 4 minutes. To cut the story down briefly, I said, I'll come for 4 months. I know the congregation, I've preached there annually for several years. And we'll see what God does, and I'll give you a rest. So I went for 4 months. He was so sure that it was God's plan that I replace him, that he totally turned loose. And I loved him enough and had enough experience with the church that I did make some dents that needed to be made. Oh, I had people come up to me, this is what we need. This is what we need. And I knew, you traitorous, judgmental worm. I wouldn't be here a year before you would be saying to some other evangelist, this is what we need. The guy I admired the most came in one day and sat on the desk, and sitting in Bond's office, and looked across at me and said, you know, I like you, Dr. Scott. You're a great teacher. You're a great pastor. And I thought, you know, I sort of thought that's strange, because in 4 months you don't do much pastoring. But he says, you ain't ever going to be able to stand in Bon Bowman's shoes. And I put it in my head, if God has me stay, this loyalty is a virtue. This man will transfer that. If I do what's right, this man will transfer his loyalty to me. And I was a new broom. I did know how to create some real discomfort for those that I recognized were not loyal to the pastor. And I built the Wednesday night Bible study up to its greatest size and began to focus on the teaching. Because Bond was so sure, after 4 months, I said, Bond, you're not done here. And I'm not ready to pastor. There's things God wants me to do. But because he had so turned loose, it's as though he got a fresh youth that without the 4 months he never could have gotten. And he came back and had his best years in Brightmoor. And I've said without that much detail many times, I'd read the day that when the Bon Bowman syndrome sets in, well, I have the courage to do what Bon didn't have the courage to do. Now, I don't have any Gene Scott to come and do for me what I did for him. The time arrived about 5 years ago. I've shared it with you openly. As I've wrestled with staff and congregation that are happy to just be as we are. Just tread water. Just maintain. Just stay in the same place. Don't put ourselves in a position like those first few years. I remember the days that we didn't know we could make it through a week. people that have turned their commitment into a job. Congregational members that have turned their commitment into a habit. And I'm sure there are people who say, well, why do you air this openly? God did. I saw a book that was being hyped across America. The Management Procedures of Moses. Moses didn't have any management procedures except when he made mistakes. I'm not interested in Moses' management procedures. I'm interested in God's management procedures. They're very clear in the Bible. God's ways are not our ways. God didn't have to share all this with the problems he had. He didn't have to fill this book with prophets moaning and groaning, pouring out the heart of God over the faithlessness of the people. And we got a church world caught up in the numbers game. I'm going to tell you something blunt. A ministry that has nothing but big crowds is not of God. Pope gets the biggest crowds of all. If the rapture came, very few of them would go. God took 3.25 million out of Egypt. As I said earlier, 2 of them into Canaan. Because the teenagers was a very small portion of that 3.25 million. Jesus finished his ministry with nobody. You say, what are you going to make an issue out of the attendance at the cathedral? Well, whether we keep it or not, that's all. I'm giving you an opportunity to make a testimony, and I will not allow you to continue to make it a testimony of shame. The quota, I'm not saying fill the building, the quota won't half fill it. Twenty-7 years is asking in this city, is there this small quota of people that will keep their word of faith and make a testimony? Well, I'm ready to buy the cathedral, close the doors, and put it on the market and sell it. Use the money to revamp a faith center and restricted to 300 seats. And if you do the same thing with me there, the 30 to 50 will not fill it every Sunday. I'm prepared to lock it up and turn it into a broadcast studio and sell this one. And I'm prepared to go back to Oroville and that little 75-seat auditorium and broadcast from there. Crowds don't bother me that much. I left a convention with 11,000 preachers in St. Louis where I preached the main message, the meaning and message of the church, to launch the Council on Evangelism. Went back to preach to 50 people because God sent me back to Oroville. Can't save you. Jesus had nobody. Had to reach outside the disciples he trained and find Paul, or his mission would have aborted. Paul ends his ministry saying, all Asia hath forsaken me, only Luke is with me. This numbers game is of the devil. All this nonsense of pseudo-prophecy preachers about the great revival before the Lord comes, my Bible talks of a falling away. in the last days like the days of Noah, not the days of Pentecost. There's nobody on earth today doing what's done at the cathedral every Sunday morning. Oh, there's a lot of thieves, plagiarizers, and copyists doing it a week or two later in various churches. Why do you air this publicly? Because God did. The Bible's full of his lamenting publicly over the failure of those that he has called. Well, why don't you fire all your staff and quit trying? Well, let me tell you something. God led them out of Egypt. And about 3 years later, having parted the Red Sea, sweetened the waters, brought water out of a rock, visited them on the mountain, brought the truth, fed them with manna, led them with a cloud and a pillar of fire. In Numbers chapter 13, you'll have to turn. They're at the promised land at Kadesh Barnea. Everything that God had promised and prepared them for. Since spies over, everything God said it was to be, it was. And Canaan's not heaven. There are no giants in heaven. No Canaanites, no Jebusites, no Amorites or Moabites produced by that incestuous thing that Lot's daughters did when they got their dad drunk and laid with him and produced the Moabites and produced the Amorites. None of those are going to be in heaven. Those Canaan was full of sinners. Canaan was the place where God's promise would be grabbed, taken, and brought to fulfillment, which is rest. Canaan is the life of faith, and that old song, "The Woman Have to Cross Jordan Alone," is a bunch of baloney. Jordan is not a type of death, and Canaan is not a type of heaven. Egypt is a type of sin. Canaan is the life of faith, and the wilderness is the living dead failure. Halfway house. No longer able to enjoy Egypt, even though it was bondage, and without enough faith to go into Canaan. That's where most of you are. Either before Kadesh Barnea or after. Depends on the individual as the type is applied. In both cases, before Kadesh Barnea, it was a preparation for faith, a demonstration of what God is, and what his promises and power mean, and a few giants made him give up and fail. After Kadesh Barnea, 37 years to train the teenagers in faith and wait for those over 20 to die. Now, I asked you 5 years ago to read Winswept House, the novel by Malachi Martin, describing the condition of the Catholic Church and the good Pope who knows the evil that is permeated, as though he wrote prophetically for the problems the Catholic Church faces today. The Pope had the power, to excommunicate all the evil ones. But it reached all the way to the Secretary of State in the novel. If he exercised his power, he crippled the church. So he kept struggling with the possibility and the Mariology of the Catholic Church. He foolishly and blindly thought that Mary would somehow solve it. She didn't. And I don't give anybody the end of the book or each self, but I said, by analogy, what I happen to think is a more important church in today's world than that one, regardless of size, namely this one. I got the windswept house problem. We're a big bureaucracy. I've told the story of the emperor who fired all the bureaucrats in the Forbidden City. Then he found he didn't have anybody who knew how to pay the bills. So he had to hire him back. We're too big for one man. That's why God has a church. Each of you in your 90% of your life have individual responsibilities, and I feed the word to you to help you make your life follow God's plan. And you are doing the Lord's work in your personal life as much as in the church work. But you're robbing God if you don't recognize there's some things that can't be done by one person. And God set the church in order and established it and said he'd build it. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Because the body has many parts. If we're all an eye, where were the hearing? If we're all an ear, where were the smelling? And he gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the completion or training and equipping, all those meanings of the word, and bringing it to completion of the saints who've given themselves to God to the work of the ministry. I can't reach the world by myself. It takes a staff. And God blessed, we fought through the fire, a church that was on the rocks. We built a fountain of faith, like those who went into the promised land, and said that we would be broadcasting until the crown, King of Kings, settles on this globe, and we'd worship with his word. And we're doing it. But I have backslidden staff members, and backslidden church members that were comfortable. As long as they got to come and have a good meal every Sunday, they felt no responsibility to find anybody else. Many Sundays I brought more people to church than they did. We're going to get a good meal. Always going to be a good meal. So if we miss this Sunday, next Sunday will be a good meal. And plus the fact we can get it off the internet or we can hear it on a rerun. So let's just stay comfortable. Don't have to sacrifice until if God doesn't honor my faith, I won't make it. We've done all that. We brought the church out of near annihilation and we're okay now. Oh, you hear the message. There's no stopping place. Ever-increasing faith, the more the saint, the older the saint, the greater the trial, can't mean you. That's got to be somebody else. We're okay. Oh, you let the pastor have a heart attack or an announcement of death for cancer and you rally. Some of you that fasted and prayed for my cancer miracle have not fasted and prayed an hour since that I would keep the healing. We're too big for me to fire everybody. That's the practical answer. But the von Bowman syndrome and the heart of love, I have staff people who have been with me 20 years. They're like spiritual sons. They grew up in this ministry. I built my life on the principle, don't try to cover your tail with me and don't give me excuses and BS and all that other stuff. But if I see a light in your eyes, you get up pointing the right direction, you got another chance. That's become a performance. I had an old timer who's been here in and out several times, decided to write me a critical letter because I didn't recognize his talent. But he confessed to another staff member that he just needed a job and some money, and he knew exactly what to say to get God, get Doc to give him another chance. I've been in a catch-22. I've wrestled with it. And I've done something about it. I've made great progress. My workload has expanded immeasurably. Without Melissa, I doubt the church would be here today. And I've shared my wife with the work that others are paid to do. She was an actress and a model and maximized her appearance. And knocked about 200 other women in a parade aside. She used to make $10,000 and $20,000 a week as a hair model, big-time hair model. She hadn't even got time to go and get her hair taken care of. She has to step in while these lummoxes around here with her ego won't do their job, and she has to do it. Let me tell you something. God. It's a good thing that Moses talked him out of starting over with Moses at Sinai. Because he would have had to wait several generations before Moses could spawn enough offspring to go in and populate Canaan and take it by faith. But at Kadesh Barnea, he said, and Moses interceded with him. And God said no. You're all dead. He killed them at Kadesh Barnea. They were as dead as if they were in a grave and in hell. Nothing would change it. They were not going to go into the promised land until all of them died 20 years of age and older. And there's no way that God was going to go in and fulfill the promise to Abraham with a bunch of untrained teenagers. So God had to wait 37 years until the last one of them died. I got my sense of humor that always bothers me in the Bible. I wonder if Caleb and Joshua sat around and the last one of the bunch that was 20 and over is hanging on to life. I'll bet they prayed, God smite him with something. We've wandered for 37 years in this wilderness waiting for this old goat to die. Now, three of them could have gone in. Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. But only Joshua and Caleb went in. Moses didn't go. So God brought him in later on the Mount of Transfiguration. He didn't have the joy of going in to Canaan. He just got to look at the land. God said, don't even talk to me about it anymore. And I prayed these years, night after night, God, I don't want to end up like Moses. Trying to save these miserable people that you've already given up on. Just think of it. Those that might sit back there as expert judges on the sidelines without the guts to commit their own life and come in and hold the pastor's arms up, onlookers and analyzers, and there's enough of a population in the church that I've had the grace to let continue to come to church even though they failed in their commitment here, that have had the time to rationalize their own failure and put the blame on the pastor. I'm not a stupid man. I know the whispers that go through the church ain't going to do you any good. When I hear it, you're gone. But it's going on. Now, you're hard to work for. I'm easier than God. Easy to work for. Someone very wise, they said, you're the hardest man in the world to work for and the easiest. What other bosses would go bananas about because they're looking at the bottom line. You can run into my $700,000 car and it's an honest mistake and I'm not even going to blink about it. You come in and say, I did it. I'm sorry. I messed it up. The only thing I can do is get something positive out of it. If you see what you did, there's nothing more to say about it. You give me a bad attitude and I'm going to put the screws on you until you either leave or see what you're doing. I'm interested in your soul. I'm interested in the bottom line. I'm not calculating how many times your salary, the work you do, has to pay off in the bottom line. That's the way the industry world works. It ain't easy to be both pastor and boss. Unless you're dealing with people that recognize that the bossing of the pastor, a la Hebrews, is watching for your soul. And there they'll sit out there, why don't you fire them all? Start off again. And I have other people come in. Why don't you hire professionals? Well, we're starting to. It's hiring centers. When I came here 27 years ago, I'd already learned this lesson elsewhere. And I swore when I came to town, I'd never hire a Christian till I died. I'm not their pastor. They either do the job or they get fired. Nothing more to talk about. When I've listened to this, sorry, sir. Oh, please forgive me, sir. You either do the job or you get out. But I'm their pastor as well as their boss. And when comes payday, they want me to be their boss. Write the check. I listen to all these sorry excuses. I don't know how to get to you. Let me stop paying them for about 2 or 3 weeks and see how creative they get. I guarantee you there isn't an employee here. If I stop paying them, won't figure out how to get to me. But they don't know how to get to me when it's a life and death matter, like tonight. I ordered the cameras to be ready tonight. We have 2 digital cameras that stay in the new news truck. It's been right here, camera number 1. I called at 8 o'clock to remind them again, having sent a cameraman engineer down here, make sure all the cameras are ready. They're all lined up like a bunch of chickens out here in the garage. I called at 8 o'clock. He said, I'll be there 9 o'clock. And I'm driving in here to have them all lined up like a bunch of chickens to tell me that 2 digital cameras were over in the news truck at King's House 1 and that we only got 2 working cameras in here on a tripod and not the number 1 camera that I needed. How to come to work and avoid getting in trouble is the mode. Not, how do I go to work learn more about my evil self, and get opportunity for more faith, and learn the lesson that Peter finally learned, that he can't save himself, but when the pressure squeezes the old man out, at least he can have the satisfaction of beating the shillelagh out of the old man. Get the heart of God, something that interferes with the church and his work and what we're called to do, would affect you like coming in and somebody's raping your daughter or your wife. You can't hardly contain yourself wanting to beat the rapist to death. When you start viewing your nature, as Peter did, that's what put Christ on the cross, and I can't die for my sins, but at least I can deal with the culprit that put him there. And I get no brownie points in heaven for doing it, but I just hate the old man that caused my Lord to die. Instead of loving it to death and cooing to that skunk inside your rib cage, your self-preservation ego. The world exploits that. All these business management techniques tell you how to deal with people that don't want to take correction. I'll give you churches, mega churches. They send out polls. What do the people want? And then they give the people what they want. The Bible talks about those kinds of hireling pastors with itching ears that do what the people want, so they'll be praised for it. I have a catch 22. I take comfort in the fact. God couldn't do it either. He had to feed those miserable rats. Lead them with a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. Provide water out of a rock. Protect them from their enemies. Take care of them. And teach them. And if they were stupid, they thought he was teaching them. He had to teach the whole congregation for the teenagers, the future of that Old Testament church, to gain the experience. They were walking dead men and women. Well, you know, you're giving the same message to the ones that apparently aren't responding as those that respond. That's what God did. He not only gave the same message to those that didn't respond, he gave the same message to the ones he wouldn't even let respond. They were dead. Dead in the 14th chapter of Numbers. Dead the third year out. 37 years walking dead men. Because their lack of faith and their fear of giants and consequences to themselves. I thought God got a sense of humor. You brought our kids out here, let them die in the wilderness. No, I'm going to let you die in the wilderness, and I'll take your kids in. I can't believe people so close to me have heard the word for so many years and apparently heard nothing. Thirty-7 years. He fed them. Their shoes didn't wear out. I repeat, water from a rock. Defeated their enemies. Ministered to them. Punished them temporarily for their continued sins that brought their death on them. Still worked through them and got his type across, set up the tabernacle, Day of Atonement every year, 37 years, blood of the heifer mixed with ashes to give comfort and grace, priests, teaching by Moses, Shekinah comes down in the Holy of Holies once a year, pick up the tabernacle and move. The pillar and the cloud led them. 37 years. Manna every day from heaven to feed them. that he despised, that he hated, because of the perversity of their nature that kept God on trial. Well, I got some snots working for me like the movie Mr. Roberts. They know more than the captain. And I've got other snots in between me and them, like Mr. Roberts, that, you know how Doc is. No, you don't. God knows how Doc is. You don't. And he hasn't changed. You have. Thirty-7 years, a long time. Now, once Jesus said, the servant's no better than the master, so I got 9 more years to go. +9, that's 37, isn't it? Was God a hypocrite? I mean, he acts like these are his people. They're dead. He's treating them all the same, but he's aiming for those teenagers. They're dead. Walking dead men. The word has no more, in fact, less effect than on a rock. Because the word spoken to a rock affected bringing water forth. The rock didn't help them. The word didn't help them. They were dead. Well, I know how Doc is, you know. We've got another crisis, but he'll get it. He'll be there Sunday. Or, you know, if we're down to the wire and he hasn't made it, then I'll maybe make a pledge. But he'll get it. We just watch these years. We can count on Doc. God wouldn't let him do that with him. I'm not as countable on as God is. God is countable upon. He didn't like their presumption. You say, you sure? Yeah. Numbers 13 and 14 is where he condemned them to death. And Numbers 20. The children of Israel came into the desert of Zin. Miriam died there. And there was no water, and they began to complain. That's 6 chapters and many years later. Wherefore have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us unto this evil place? There's no place of seed or figs or vines or pomegranate, neither is any water to drink. This ain't the promised land. Well, there weren't any giants there, I might say satirically. And God told Moses to speak to the rock, because the rock was a symbol of Christ. And Moses got so mad, he killed 3,000 people at the foot of the hill at Sinai. And some people have criticized him for his anger. He came back and told God to smite him, and he said, I'll smite him that sinned. So he didn't take Moses' anger at Sinai as a sin, because he didn't. His anger flowed in the stream of God's revelatory plan as the type that the law in man's hand is broken, and it will only be unbroken inside Christ, typified in the ark. So his anger did not conflict with God's revelation. But his anger in Numbers 20, God told him to speak to the rock because the rock's only to be smitten once because Christ only suffered once. And the type of the Christ, instead of obeying and speaking to the rock and fulfilling what Paul was saying in Romans 10, we don't have to go up and get him or bring him down. We just speak the word Nias. The work was done in the type of the first smiting of the rock with the rod of judgment, by the way. Moses was so angry, he screamed at those people, "You rebels, you bunch of rebels." He struck the rock. And in so doing, he marred God's revelatory plan by making the type of Christ be smitten twice. And God said, because you didn't do as I told you, you won't go to the promised land. Now, I want you to look at what a fool Moses was. He's screaming at those rebels as though he expects them not to be rebels. He's screaming at those people as though there's hope for them. They should have not acted this way. That's the way the murmuring is almost identical in the words they say to what they said at Kadesh Barnea. He forgot they were walking dead men. In other words, he was still trying to save what God had killed. Pretty scary, isn't it? That's what I'm doing, I think, with a lot of people. I could do 3 festivals a day. Sit here and do 3 festivals a day, 7 days a week. With the time I spend preaching to my staff, you've heard it all, had no more impact than if I talked to a stone. They don't want to change. They say they do, but they don't. Because of the price. Die to self, come alive to Him. Turn from fear to faith, from self-preservation to self-denial. They won't do that. It's like people who want to be humble but don't want to be humiliated. Humble is the state that is produced by being humiliated. The method by which you become humble is to be humiliated. Take a look at yourself. They don't want to. I don't want to be this way. Yeah, they do. The point I'm making is God couldn't take them in. God, with all His power, couldn't take them in. It wasn't according to His plan. And Moses was trying to save those rebels. They were nothing but walking dead men. For another illustration, it's even more scary. I'm going to read from another version. This Word Bible Commentary, 1 Samuel. The title of this chapter, 2nd chapter, verses 11 to 36. Good son, singular, good son, bad sons. Good son, bad sons. I'm going to read a modern, very accurate translation. This is the story of Samuel, who was dedicated by Hannah, and she dedicated him. Eli was the priest, remember, that Samuel ran to when he heard a voice, and then Eli told him that it was God speaking. And then Samuel is dedicated to God and is serving in the temple. She, Hannah, his mother, went to Ramah, while the boy carried on the service of Yahweh, God, the Lord, in the presence of Eli the priest. This is her son Samuel, dedicated to God. The sons of Eli were good for nothings. They didn't obey Yahweh. This is what was due the priest from the people. Whenever someone was making a sacrifice, an attendant of the priest would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the cauldron and cooking pot. Whatever the fork brought up, the priest would get for himself. But this is what, that's what they should have done, but this is what they did to all Israel who came there at Shiloh. Before they had burned the fat, the attendant of the priest would come and say to the person sacrificing, "Donate some meat to the priest for roasting. He will not accept boiled meat from you." If the man would say, "Let them burn the fat as usual, and then you can take for yourself whatever you want," the attendant would reply, "No, but you shall give it now, and if you do not, I will take it by force." The sin of the attendants was exceedingly serious in the sight of Yahweh, since they were despising Yahweh's offering. The commentary has some comments over here that I'll just say as a sidebar. They had been guilty of despising the offerings of Yahweh, so they are without hope. I have people in the counting room opening the mail and counting and categorizing your gifts of tithe and offering that belong to God. They've gotten a state of mind, or just paper. I had to deal with one some long time ago, still the attitude occasionally. "Oh, good, there's no alabaster boxes today. We don't have any responsibility or burden to get to Doc about it." Treating the mailbags as just paper junk. Somebody who has a responsibility to be here with a car, his car isn't working, they decide they can go on the mail run in one car. The slightest breakdown on a freeway, and what we have given up hundreds of millions of dollars to protect the sanctity of your donations becomes government property in an impounded car. They're left on the side of the road because there's no chase car. Trying to keep it from me, it's happening. They've been guilty of despising the offerings of Yahweh. At the same time, Samuel was ministering in the presence of Yahweh as an attendant girded with a linen ephod. His mother would make him a little robe and bring it up annually when she came up with her husband to perform the annual sacrifice. Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife, saying, "May Yahweh restore to you children from this woman instead of the child who was obtained by request, whom she dedicated to Yahweh." And God did that. I'll skip along. Eli was very old. When he would hear what his sons were doing to the Israelites, he would say to them, "Why are you acting in accord with these bad words which I hear from the mouth of all the people of Yahweh? No, my sons, do not do this, for the reports are not good which I hear. The people of Yahweh are spreading it around. If a man sin against another man, God will mediate for him. But if a man sin against Yahweh..." By the way, people of Israel never ever sassed or talked back to God. They never ever judged God. There's no record of it. They sassed, talked back, and murmured against Moses. But when God killed them, he viewed it as murmuring against him. I came here 27 years ago and said, "You will learn, this church will be restored to faith and respect for the God-ordained office of the pastor." I will credit the congregation. Most of them have come to that. I fight every day the disrespect of a staff that's like teenagers who love their dad, would die for him in an emergency spontaneously, but they know more than he knows. And they have They respect me. They don't respect the office. Big difference. Not every pastor will have been given the opportunity or the gifts that God has given me. My dad never finished the fourth grade. He was the pastor. It's an office. No ascend. Ham judged. Shem and Japheth covered. Now, my sons, do not do this. If a man sin against another man, God will mediate for him. When you came into the staff here, you're in a position, you better figure out who it is you're sinning against. If a man sin against Yahweh, who will pray for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father. Everybody knows that, don't they? You know the story of Eli. They would not listen to the voice of their father. Very few of you know the rest of the sentence. Let me read it to you. But they would not listen to the voice of their father because Yahweh desired to kill them. Let me try it again. They would not listen to the voice of their father because Yahweh wouldn't let them. Yahweh closed their mind. They had crossed a line with him. Some old walking dead men. There was no getting back. Don't expect to see Miriam, who sang that song on the other side of the Red Sea. Don't expect to see her in heaven. She ain't going to be there. Don't expect to see any of those Israelites in heaven. Over 20, they're not going to be there. God says in Hebrews, you better be afraid lest we be like them. They did always put him on trial. They had a pernicious heart of disbelief. Jesus said, if you don't understand the parable of the sower, you don't understand anything. As I taught on it, it makes clear that some people God doesn't want. Everybody has a chance at the outset. When God calls you, you're obviously one of those that's called, but not many are called, few are chosen. There's nothing worse that can happen than a continued disresponse to the Word, a continued disfaithness, a continued self-servingness. Well, I don't want this. Elisha didn't want Elijah to come out of the woods and change his life. The calling and election of God is without recall. Every single one of you in the sound of my voice have come to the kingdom for this hour. You will go one of two directions and there's no neutral. They would not listen, did not listen to their father because Yahweh, the Lord, desired to kill him, wanted to kill him. Tended to kill them. They were dead. And he killed them all. If you read on in the story, including Eli, wiped out the line, spared one that he said would die weeping, and that one was spared by joining with David and fleeing when the priests of Nob, descendants of Eli, were all killed, and joined David with the ephod that let God speak to David through the Urim and Thummim, And then he cited, in David's old age, with another candidate for the throne, except Solomon, that had been promised. And he gets banished and dies with tears in the wilderness. This is the age of grace, but some of my staff and some of this congregation are hanging over the lip of the precipice. And you have come to the kingdom for this hour, and it's time for you to decide whether self's going to rule or God's going to rule. And for all I know, some of you, I'm as hopeless. I'm not going to do what Moses did and still try to save the unsavable and still expect the walking dead. I've exhausted too many years trying to do it. The few years I have left has got to mine the youth of this church and find somebody else. I don't know which of you, congregation and staff, been here too long, and you've already crossed the line. Moses was still trying to save the unsavable. The New Testament speaks of the impasse feeling. And you know how you can tell a little bit tonight? They would not listen to their father. It wasn't their choice. Because the Lord had decided and wanted to kill them. I can't get inside your mind. God is. There are staff members sitting in front of me and listening tonight that are probably over the line. There's nothing I can say that you will listen to. Because God wants to kill you. Spiritually and naturally. All the crying in the world wouldn't get Esau back, wouldn't get Saul back. We can get these Israelites back, and we can get those sons of Eli back. There's a line you can cross. You sin willfully, the New Testament says, no more remission. This is the kind of willful sin. Just a deliberate presumption. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to avoid pain. I'm going to avoid the conflict. I'm going to avoid responsibility. I want to be comfortable. I want to have a halo around me. And I want to get a paycheck, and I'm working for the Lord, and I want to force pastor and God to take my sacrifice in place of obedience. Well, you may be able to fool me. In your own heart of hearts tonight, the degree to which you are listening, and the degree to which you were hoping I would finish so you could find a place to cry out to God for mercy, it's about the best telegraph signal you can get of whether or not God wants to kill you. Same goes for the congregation that has refused to step forward with the secret 15 and puts God, His Word, and me through this agony every Sunday because you just don't want to make a commitment to be in your spot on Sunday morning. That's all I got to say tonight. Next move is yours. Get on the telephone. Crew, get back in there. Now, we are still alive. We're not going home. I said, you who are listening, there's hope for you. Some of you can't listen. God finish with you. Some of you listening tonight are at Kadesh Barnea. You haven't yet said no and turned faithless and self-preserving for the last time. Some of you, you're just turning me off. At least I'm intelligent enough in God's Word to understand that His faithful, true shepherds who don't have His power or His insight to see inside people, to fulfill their role, keep trying, in Moses' case, too much, to where he cost himself the promised land. Pretty sober what I'm telling you. There are people that drive all the way from San Francisco to the cathedral. One man going to fly from Houston Sunday. Another will drive from Phoenix. I didn't have a single reservation during that song. We still have 52 to go. And I still have 64 now. Now we're getting close. On anniversary Sunday, we'll have 2 months till Christmas. You know, I can sympathize with those Israelites more than I can sympathize with you. The giants that they saw could kill them. The faith challenge you're facing ain't going to kill you. You just don't want to do it. You just haven't got the faith to believe that you and God can get it done. There isn't one of you listening to me that in an emergency, God put any one of you in the hospital, you'll spend more than $5,000. And you would find it to preserve yourself. I don't preach a sobering message like this very often. I didn't even like to spend the time I spent in Romans on the wrath of God. Well, no, God can't do this. Look. In another passage, it said to Eli, don't even remind me that I promised you a perpetual priesthood in the loins of Aaron. I know what I said then, but this is what I'm saying now. And he killed Eli. And I'm cutting your line off. You're not listening very good if I don't get some response. Now get on the telephone. All right, we have 45 to go now. I'm waiting for someone to say, I'm going to believe God, and I commit the 5,000 to secret 15. I know these are sobering words tonight. My hope is you still have the capacity to listen. Which means God hadn't made his mind up. You're none of his. It's the past feeling, people. That have crossed the line. I've taught you the unpardonable sin is not some particular deed. There's all kinds of deeds that can push you past the line. You know it's happened when you're in a state of mind, you're past feeling, you resist the word, you're not responsive. Look in the mirror and decide whose side you're on tonight. Now get on the telephone. There's Washoe Valley, Nevada, a dishwasher. Not a dishwasher, but a dishwasher. The question about stamps, use Federal Express. And Victory Sunday is Christmas Sunday. Whatever is designated Christmas Sunday, it's Victory Sunday. That's when Secret 15 has to be in. Now, come on, we have about 13 more minutes here. with the phones open, and I want your calls and your reservations, and I'm waiting for the next Secret 15 pledge. Get on the phone. I remember a night when we were going for Hope Street after midnight, about this time, a spirit of hilarious giving hit the congregation. I couldn't hardly keep up with the pledges. Now get on the phone. Get out of the bondage of non-faith. We have 42 to go to reach our quota of reservations. And we still have 64 to go to reach the goal for Secret 15. Everybody that's watching should keep faith on the line at this hour. Now get on the phone and keep talking faith until someone out there figures out they're either going to go back in the wilderness or forward to Canaan in faith. Now get on the phone. Well, I have 40 to go now. 40 to go in reservations. And I'm telling you, when this plays as reruns, you better act as though God timed the rerun for you. Because these reservations will come in if you have a listening heart. If you don't, I wouldn't be in your shoes for anything. Now get on the telephone.